This is Jim Engster. Coming today, we will talk with filmmaker Zach Godshall and writer Susan Schaller. They have combined for a documentary, A Man Without Words, showing tonight at the Manship Theater. Also on the show, Kirby Goidell of LSU and Jeff Nagel of Tulane, two professors, have collaborated on a major study regarding childhood development in Louisiana. And we will also hear from the man who runs the Coastal Sustainability Studio at LSU, Jeff Carney, a major issue in our state, and Jeff Carney has the latest on what's happening at the Old War School regarding the program that is ongoing at LSU. All this today, now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Engster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Hope you had a great weekend. Thanks for joining us today. And our guests to begin our show are filmmaker Zach Godshall and writer Susan Schaller. They have collaborated on a documentary, A Man Without Words. It is showing tonight at the Manship Theater. And this production is possible through the assistance and the sponsorship of the linguistics program at LSU. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
All right, thanks.
Well, let's start with you, Susan. It's a documentary about something that you're well familiar with, hearing impairment, and one person in particular, a deaf man. Tell us about the genesis of this particular work, A Man Without Words.
Well, first of all, I met accidentally when I was 17 the deaf community. Not hearing impaired, but actually profoundly deaf, and that's very different. They're completely visual and have developed a visual culture and a visual language, and I fell in love with it. I just thought, this is fantastic. And I became a sign language interpreter and was called to interpret for a class. And at that class, I met this man who had, I slowly discovered, no language, didn't understand signing, didn't understand what we did with our mouths, and I was amazed. I couldn't believe that a human being could be intelligent and otherwise normal and not know language, not know what it was.
And so you followed this this gentleman, and lo and behold, you end up writing about it, and the book was actually written several years ago, right?
Right, right. And a new edition has just come out just a few months ago.
1991 was the
original publication date. New edition with a chapter called Ildefonso's chapter, my former student, and he still gives me surprises and inspires me. So the new chapter in the book is a surprise to me as well as.
Well, the book was at the time reviewed by the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post. The story and study of a 27-year-old deaf man who Susan teaches how to speak for the first time. And Zach Godshall, filmmaker of note, how did you get involved?
Right. Well, it's interesting because Susan, you know, lives in California. The story happened in California. I usually working around here, but I read an interview with Susan in a magazine published out of Oakland called Works and Conversations. And in this interview, she told the story of meeting this man, Ildefonso, and after reading it, I just thought, I got to get involved with this somehow. This is an incredible story. It's one of the most amazing stories I've ever come across, and it's very powerful and brings up plenty of questions about, you know, language and communication and then just kind of just basic human nature. So started speaking with Susan. We have a lot of similar interests, and we both feel the same way about the story, and the collaboration just sort of developed out of that pretty naturally.
Well, the book, as stated, was written 22 years ago. Have you followed the path of the young man who is the principal?
We've stayed friends. I used to, when I was in Southern California, I used to see him at least once a year on his birthday. And now that I've moved to Northern California, it's harder to see him, but I try as often as I can.
You live in Berkeley, California,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a lot like Baton Rouge, right?
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Both start with B. Yeah.
Both college towns. Yeah. Well, it's a story that is quite compelling, A Man Without Words, a nonfiction account of Susan's encounter with a languageless deaf man to whom she introduced language and how did you do that? What, how can you teach somebody who's deaf to speak?
That's a really good question. I didn't teach him to speak. I taught him to talk. I taught him to sign and to introduced him to the idea of language. But it's a really good question. How do you teach language through language? How do you teach signs through signs? How do you teach words through words? It was almost impossible. I thought it was impossible. I went home and cried a couple nights because I was so frustrated. It was the most frustrating thing I've ever done in my life. And then one day he got it. He got it. And the breakthrough was the same as Helen Keller's breakthrough with water, when W-A-T-E-R was spelled in her hand, and she go, "Oh, I get it. It's that stuff. You're talking about that stuff, water." And his breakthrough was with C-A-T, with cat and the sign for cat. And he go, "Oh, I get it. Everything has a name." And he actually went sort of crazy and started pointing at everything. And one of the most amazing things is that it looked as if he saw things for the first time, now that he knew that everything had a name, a shared name, something we can share with each other. And that's interesting. Language changes us and changes our brains.
How long had you been acquainted with American Sign Language when you had this assignment to help this young man?
I first met American Sign Language when I was 17, and I met him when I was 22.
So just 5 years.
Yeah.
And it was a success story. So
yes.
How long did it take before you knew it was going to be a success?
Well, when I left him, I was his only teacher ever, actually, for 4 months, and then he had to get a job, and so that was the end of that. So when I left him, it was just baby talk, but that was already a success. I mean, baby sentences are, it's still language.
Right.
So we're thrilled when our three-year-olds are, or two-year-olds rather, are talking in three-word sentences. And I left him when he was signing three signed sentences, but I knew he could now access language, because then he could tap you on the shoulder and talk to you if you were deaf and start signing. And so I knew he was on his way.
Mm-hmm. Now, the director is Zach Godshall. He is the screenwriter in residence at LSU and has been with us before. His debut as a director, lo and behold, was an official selection of the 2007 Sundance Film Festival, and he followed that Lord Byron, right?
Right, and somewhere in between there, God's Architects.
God's Architects. We've talked
right,
to you about
I
that.
Was
yeah,
here before,
yeah. So, yeah. And now this. How does this compare with your other works?
Well, I've been sort of going back and forth between fictional and documentary film. So this is a straight documentary, but in a way the story is already there. So it was almost kind of like having a prepared story. So it was a great collaboration working with Susan, and then actually meeting Ildefonso, this man. He's now a little over 30 years after the time that they met. And
how old is he?
He's, I guess,
62.
Okay, and he's now the head gardener at a really nice hospital in San Diego, and he designs all their gardens, and very respected at the hospital there. So it really was great working with him. He's very proud of his gardens, and so the film is a short film. It's 20 minutes. It tells the story of how Susan met Ildefonso, and then the film ends with Ildefonso showing off his gardens that he's created.
So tonight at 7, the film shows, and then after the film?
We'll have some sort of talk and discussion. Susan will have a dialogue with the audience about the subject, because it is such a brings up so many questions. We'll have a reception and a book signing afterwards. And the whole event is free. It's sponsored by the couple of departments at LSU, Linguistics and Communication Disorders and the English Department. And the Manship Theater is hosting us, so it's all very much a great community event here.
You've learned a lot about people who are deaf, and I know in the book, the foreword was written by a famed neurologist. What do you know that you can impart to lay people such as yours truly about the challenges and the opportunities for people who have the inability to speak as we are speaking today?
Thank you for saying the word opportunities, because I think the number one message I would like to impart every day is that we have something to learn from everybody. Every personality has something new to offer, mm-hmm. and every group, and that, you know, every language group has something to offer. And if we saw what deaf people have instead of what they don't have, then they wouldn't be languageless. They wouldn't, you know, it would be, if we had a deaf baby, it's like, what could I learn from my deaf baby about vision? And allow a deaf person to be visual. Oliver Sacks, the neurologist, talks about the plasticity of the brain, and that means that we're born with the ability to make a new brain. And that means if you're deaf, you learn how to see better, and they're actually visually superior to us. So we can learn how to see better from deaf people.
Well, tonight you'll hear more from writer Susan Schaller, the author of A Man Without Words. The book in 1991 was celebrated, and now it is a documentary film from Zach Godshaw, LSU alumnus, screenwriter in residence, and the 2009 Louisiana Filmmaker of the Year. What's your next project, Zach?
Well, I'm currently finishing up a full-length documentary right now that's just set down along the coast of Louisiana, and it is about a small town along the coast that has suffered a lot of the wetlands loss, and it's the community has sort of eroded over the past 50 years for various reasons, and so it's a portrait of the coast as it is, you know, today. And that's another way to kind of, you know, present a story to a community at large, but also in Louisiana, of a story that's very familiar to us, but to kind of look at it in a different way, see people who are living there and working on the coast today.
Well, in 2007, Zach's movie, Lo and Behold, was the first feature-length film by a Louisiana movie maker to play at Sundance since Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotapes to videotape in 1989 and Glenn Peet's Belisaire of the Cajun in 1986. That's good company.
Right, sure is.
And Sex, Lies, and Videotape, hard as it is to believe, it's 25 years ago this summer that movie was made right here in Baton Rouge with Steven Soderbergh. And it was 31 years ago tonight that John Belushi spent his last night on the planet at 8221 Sunset Boulevard, Chateau Marmont in Los Angeles, California. You remember him, don't you?
I've heard of him.
Well, he was quite an entertainer and one of Kevin Gallagher's favorites, so I thought it would be appropriate to salute John Belushi. He was only 33 years old when he passed away. He was headed for Paramount Studios for an appointment the next day with none other than Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg, who were running Paramount at the time, and he never made it because he overdosed, I think it was in bungalow number 3 at the Chateau Marmont. But John Belushi, who was one of the originators of Saturday Night Live, 1975, here was a sampling that Kevin's found of Mr. Belushi.
Well, I was making musical history, but now I'm working for muscular dystrophy. Muscular
history.
Oh, muscular
history.
Oh, muscular
history.
Oh, muscular
history.
That's John Belushi, not Joe Cocker. And speaking of anniversaries, one that I think the Louisiana media, and that would include me, we missed it. February 21st was the 25th anniversary of Jimmy Swaggart's famous I Have Sinned confession to his congregation at the Swaggart Ministries, not so far from where we are now. And why the Advocate didn't do a 25-year later report on Jimmy Swaggart is somewhat curious, although Swaggart is their landlord, so a rent increase might have been in the offing had that occurred. But nonetheless, Jimmy Swaggart remains one of the biggest employers and certainly one of the most famous, if not the most famous person in this community. And he remains a worldwide phenomenon. He turned 78 years old on March 15th. And here's how Jimmy Swaggart sounded on that afternoon of February 21st, 1988, when he confessed,
"I have sinned against you, my Lord. And I would ask that your precious..."
Now, why didn't somebody, Kevin Gallagher, do a story on Jimmy Swaggart 25 years later? That's something that warrants attention. He remains one of Louisiana's most prominent people. And in Baton Rouge, there are few people more prominent than Reverend Jimmy Lee Swaggart, born March 15th, 1935, in Faraday, Louisiana. We'll return with LSU's Kirby Goidell and Tulane's Jeff Nagel on early childhood development in Louisiana after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined now by two distinguished professors, one from Tulane University and the other from LSU, and two great universities in Louisiana. Two of the great ones have collaborated for something called the Early Childhood Policy and Data Center, and Dr. Jeff Nagel and Dr. Kirby Goidell are here to discuss some fascinating information about our state and some of the numbers involving children. Numbers in our case are not so good. Good morning to you, gentlemen.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Let's begin with you, Dr. Nagel. As far as children and the information that is derived from the study, which was led last year, for most of last year, by Dr. Goidell and his staff, what are some of the most interesting nuggets of information that you have derived from the information that has been presented?
Sure. Well, the report is called Early Childhood Risk and Reach in Louisiana, and it was designed to really document risk for young children, children under the age of five, growing up in the state. And while there are some national reports that look at how children are doing across the states, there's no national report that's specifically focused on young children. And while our state, unfortunately, has traditionally done very poorly in those national rankings, we are obviously aware that there's differences throughout the state. There are areas of the state doing better and areas of the state doing worse on various indicators. But our belief going into this was that there would be areas, that all areas would have strengths and weaknesses. So every community would have something to build on and something to work toward. And that's really what we found across the state.
And Dr. Kirby Goidell, these numbers are a bit different than those that you unearth when you conduct a survey. It takes a lot of time and energy and resources to put together this kind of information.
Yeah, this is a lot of secondary data collection where we're going out and we're identifying first the risk factors that we believe are important that we can get at the parish level that are as recent as possible and looking at them and comparing them across parishes to get an idea of how the different parishes measure in terms of economic risk, health risk, and educational risk.
And when we look at percentage of births to single mothers, for example, one of the major statistics in the study. In East Carroll Parish, the poorest parish in the United States, perhaps, 79.8% of the mothers are unwed. Is this a surprise at all?
I think it's always a little shocking to see some of the numbers, and especially when you're looking at unwed mothers. I think one of the other things that I think though is striking in the data is that while we think about risk being connected to poverty, which is included as one of the measures, it's not just poverty that it captures other types of indicators as well.
What are some of the others?
Well, when we look at across economics, most of it is tied to poverty. But when we look at health, you can see that some of the parishes are actually they rate low on economic factors, but they may rate high on health factors or vice versa. So when we look at teen birth rate, or we look at infant mortality rate, or we look at the percent of children uninsured, the different risk factors play out differently in different parts of the state.
And these numbers correlate on any number of other measurements. Parish level percent of mothers with less than high school degree. Once again, if we look at the poorest parish, East Carroll, it's 25.4%, although there are some parishes that have even higher numbers than that.
Yeah, and definitely there are differences across the parishes in some of those numbers. So it goes beyond simply trying to identify sort of poverty as the key indicator.
And in Baton Rouge, for example, East Baton Rouge Parish, 56% of the births in this parish are to single mothers. Going across the river to West Baton Rouge, it's 52%. And nationally, the number is 40.8%. What do you do with these numbers? They mean something, but they may mean more to somebody like you, Dr. Nagel, than they do to laymen like me.
Well, I think obviously the numbers are striking to everyone, and everyone has a different perspective, and depending on the type of work they do or what they're we talk about everyone as stakeholders, and so every stakeholder, I think, should be impacted by all of this. And again, because there's strengths and weaknesses everywhere, even in the areas that you pointed out that do have the most economic challenges. I think overall what you're talking about here is how do we change the trajectory for a lot of young children who are growing up in some very high-risk environments. We have 111,000 children, about 35% of the children in the state, that are in the high-risk or the moderate high-risk categories. So you begin to back up and say, well, what are our investments in our young children? And fortunately, Louisiana is maybe the only state that has a focused early childhood budget that the state government puts out. So we know exactly what the state investments are in our children. So of our $25-plus billion budget, we know about 5% of that budget goes toward young children. So then again, depending on where you sit at the table in the argument, you could say that's too little. Maybe you think it's too much. Of the state dollars in the budget, only less than 3% of our state dollars go toward young children. So really, you begin to have more information to say, are we making the right strategic investments with our limited resources for our children? And then depending on those investments, are they reaching the kids most at risk? And that's what the second half of this report really gets to. Of the programs the state provides, how are they meeting the need based on the risk that we came up with the composite overall risk score based on those 11 indicators?
Okay. One other number that I have referred to on this program many times is that the poverty level in our state is higher than it is nationally, maybe not as much higher as some might think. For example, it's 27.7% in East Baton Rouge Parish, which is high, but the national average is 23.4. And for those who think that 27.7% is a bad number, or maybe not as bad as you would anticipate, think about the level. The poverty level for a family of four is $21,767 a year. So 27.7% of the people in East Baton Rouge Parish are living below that level. In East Carroll Parish, the parish that I've noted a few times before, that number is 76.8%. So what kind of quality of life is possible? How can children have a chance when they're growing up in these conditions?
Right. That is a great question. And, you know, we have to think about how do children experience the world and how do they experience the poverty? So children experience the world through their adult relationships. Who are their caretakers? Obviously, if their caretakers, their parents, or whoever is taking care of them, perhaps their grandparents, if those people are impoverished, if they are suffering all of the stresses that come from being in poverty, having to work multiple jobs, not having a job, substance abuse, mental health issues that aren't being treated, all of those things then impact that adult's ability to have a strong, healthy, secure relationship with the child. And that's really the crossroad of opportunity and the crossroad of risk for the child. So we have to help the adults so that they can have those strong relationships with the children so that children can not be as negatively impacted from all of the constellation of problems that come with poverty. But it's not the poverty per se that the child's going to feel. It's their world, which is really all about the adults.
We're visiting with Dr. Jeff Nagel from Tulane University, Dr. Kirby Goidell from LSU. Now, there is a number in here that Dr. Nagel referred to about the parish level overall risk, the best possible score being 1, the worst possible score being 4. Dr. Goidell, what are some of the findings here that are most prominent?
Well, I think what we see is that there are parishes that are clearly high across a number of risk factors. And what you really see is a lot of it is where you would expect, especially in the Mississippi Delta region, but also some parishes up in the northeastern part of the state or northwestern part of the state as well, where you see a high risk across each of these factors. I think it's important to keep in mind that this is relative to other parishes is how we've defined risk. So when you look in the context of Louisiana, these are the places that children are most at risk. It's not an overall measure of risk relative to the U.S.
But it is a fascinating correlation between poverty and overall risk. There's no getting around it.
Yeah, poverty is one of the most important factors that play out. But there are some factors like, for example, if you look at the percent of low birth weight babies in East Carroll, you've noted East Carroll on a number of different indicators, but it's kind of a low to moderate risk factor on that particular measure. So it's not the only thing that we want to take into account. And we also want to think about how the interventions that we may put into place may depend on the type of risk at in a particular community. So there are some wealthier parishes nurses that are high risk on a particular indicator, and so you want to think about how you address those risks differently than you would in a parish that's very poor.
And actually, the parish with the worst score, if you will, is Madison, neighboring East Carroll, 3.36. East Carroll, on that measurement, the final one is at 3.18, but to give some examples, St. Tammany is at 1.36, and East Baton Rouge Parish is at 2.55, kind of middle of the pack. Orleans Parish is at 2.82. So you've been in this state almost 20 years, Dr. Nagel. We've had these problems from the time you arrived and well before you arrived. What can we do so that 20 years from now somebody else isn't in this studio talking about the same kinds of concerns and issues?
Right. That is a great challenge, and the opportunities are enormous. But we have to understand that when we talk about investments in early childhood, we're not just talking about early education. Too many times I think the conversation, the words early childhood and early education get they're used interchangeably, and they're really, it's much more than that. Early education is a component of strong early childhood development. But children have health issues, they have mental health issues, they need their parents to be economically secure and understand parenting. They need to have family support opportunities if their families need them. So right now, we have an opportunity in the state. There's a lot of work going on around reforming the early education system. But the concern there is that we're being too focused on one component. And so we can spend a lot of energy there, but we're not paying attention to the other health concerns, which this report documents, the other issues around safety and overall development that are going to be the key. When we talk about education for young kids, everyone wants to know, you know, what's their vocabulary, what's their literacy, are they reading by third grade? But when children aren't reading by third grade, we have to back up and say, well, how did that happen? And really, the skills that young children need to master before they start school are what economists might even call soft skills. You know, perseverance, self-control, curiosity, conscientiousness, inquisitiveness, all of these things, grit, determination, those indicators are much more predictive of long-term academic success and long-term physical health. We know this from longitudinal studies. If we really wanted to pay attention to the key indicators, and it's much harder to get at them than just saying, does this child know how to read by the time they're 5 years old? And that's the trick. We have to get away from the overly focused work on literacy and help children really develop the skills that are much more predictive of their later life success educationally and in terms of their own personal health.
There are an estimated 314,260 children under age 5 in Louisiana, according to the report prepared by Dr. Goidel and company. And of these young people, 111,034 live in either the moderate high or high-risk parishes, representing approximately 35.3% of all children under the age of 5 in Louisiana. With the budget cuts that are ongoing, how can these problems be addressed adequately?
Well, I think that's a real challenge. And what we're seeing, unfortunately, are the dollars that are going toward young children are shrinking. Program by program, it's a different story. But in terms of subsidized dollars for child care, we have no state dollars in that anymore. It's all federal money. So that's been reduced 25% in the last 4 years. We had a home visiting program, one of the most evidence-based early childhood interventions in the country, and that's been reduced on an annual basis, 15%, based on the cuts that just happened in December. We had a nationally recognized mental health program for young children, very mm-hmm. small, serving only a small number of kids in the state, and that was completely eliminated in December. So we haven't, you know, fortunately, we haven't seen the cuts in the pre-K program. But again, that's my concern is, yes, we certainly celebrate that we have preserved the investments in pre-K, but for early childhood success, it's much bigger than just pre-K. And so our challenges are increasing as the dollars shrink. There's no doubt about it.
We're hearing from Dr. Jeff Nagel, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Tulane, the School of Medicine, and the Director of the Tulane University Institute of Infant and Early Childhood Mental Health. Also, the state director of Bright Start, Louisiana's early childhood Advisory Council, and with him is Dr. Kirby Goidell, who's been with us many times discussing politics. He's the Scripps Howard Professor of Mass Communication and Professor of Political Science at LSU. Kirby, how did the two of you guys get together on this?
We actually met in a leadership class, Leadership Louisiana, in 2004, and I think I'm in required by law to say that it's the best class ever.
So. But Tulane and LSU through the years have not collaborated as much as they probably should have.
I agree, and I'm from out of state, and certainly when I came here for graduate school, one of the first things you learn is that Tulane and LSU aren't necessarily the best of friends, but clearly there's a lot of great opportunity, and when the institutions work together, that's a win for everybody.
Well, you're in one of the most beautiful areas of the world. At Tulane University, of course, is nestled in a beautiful part of Louisiana and of America, and LSU is a garden spot for our community. Is there a tendency when we get in our little cocoons to ignore what's going on beyond the gates of LSU, for example? If you walk 4 or 5 blocks, you'll see a different world.
Absolutely. I think that's a real challenge, and you get caught up in your day-to-day, and just like any other job, but maybe even worse so in a university setting, because you are enclosed in a campus environment. So it's pretty important to take notice of the problems around you.
Is the infrastructure in place to address these issues, these challenges we have in Louisiana?
Well, again, that's always the challenge. And, you know, infrastructure doesn't just magically happen. It has to be funded. It has to be funded with smart investments, and has to be funded with leadership, which is charged to carry out certain mandates. And with the reductions, it's been tougher. But, again, I think with the information that is available, reports like this, the early childhood budget that the state puts out, people have the information to say, we want more done for early childhood. And Kirby's done a lot of work in terms of documenting what are the public opinions about these types of investments. Again, we make only 5% of our state budget is spent on early childhood. And, you know, there's a lot of economists out there now, including Nobel Prize winning economists, that are saying the best use of public dollars are investments made in young children. And so when we're always hearing about government being more efficient, government making the best use of our dollars, how does that jive with the reality that only 5% of our investments are in young children? So I think, you know, we need to all look at the facts, and that's what Kirby and I are trying to do, is put information out there that different stakeholders, whether you're in government or outside of government, whether you're in the executive branch of government or the legislative branch, that you're going to have information that's going to help you make informed decisions using the finite resources that we have.
Well, for someone who would like to peruse the same numbers that I've been looking at, how do we do so?
Well, we have a website. It's www.lsutuearlychild.org.
The LSU Tulane Early Childhood Policy and Data Center. It's a collaboration of the LSU Riley Center for Media and Public Affairs and the Tulane Institute of Infant and Early Childhood Mental Health, and the mission is to conduct policy-relevant research, collect timely and appropriate data, and provide statistical and economic analysis to inform early childhood policy decisions. Thank you, Dr. Kirby Goidell and Dr. Jeff Nagel.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and our guest for our final segment is Jeff Carney. He is the director of the LSU Coastal Sustainability Studio, founded by Robert Twilley. And Jeff is a man in charge, an important part of our state, of course, and of Louisiana State University. Good morning to you, Dr. Carney.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, tell us about what you're doing at the Coastal Sustainability Studio. That's a big title, but it is, as stated, based on what's happened here in the last decade, I think most people would appreciate that hurricanes are a big part of our lives, and they're not going away, and what you're doing will help us address those concerns.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen some tremendous challenges in the last decade, and these problems are much larger than any one discipline can handle. And what the studio really tries to do is break down the barriers between the disciplines. We were founded as a collaborative between School of Coast and the Environment, The College of Engineering and the College of Design, specifically the architecture and landscape architecture department, and we're located in the College of Design. We really focus on building capacity within the university to deal with these issues in a sort of a transdisciplinary way, being able to speak across the disciplines. We do that through design projects. So our work is located in communities, in the issues facing the state, in a very sort of public and outreach-heavy kind of way, and really try to impact the state's ability to deal with these issues through educating the sort of future workforce of the state, as well as a real faculty-driven research projects.
When you say design projects, how do they work?
Our projects focus on getting at least three disciplines together on a project. So we look at work that's specifically too big or too complex for any one discipline. We've worked in a number of communities across the state. Originally, we took on a project in the 9th Ward of New Orleans, looking at the environmental impacts, the large-scale restoration projects, all the way down to the architectural development.
What did you find in the 9th Ward?
One of the things that we really found with that project was that the scale of restoration that we were talking about in terms of the Central Wetlands Unit was extremely large compared to the scale of the actual neighborhood. And as researchers, the coastal scientists working at this larger scale, engaging with landscape architects working on a much smaller scale than dealing with architects working on the scale of a house, was really how could we bridge those gaps. We developed a series of scenarios with a group called the Center for Sustainable Engagement and Development in the 9th Ward that would then go back and allow the community to make decisions that enhance their resilience, their ability to adapt to restoration as it was developed.
297-5633 is your number outside the area, 877-217-5757. Our remaining segment is filled with the words of Jeff Carney, director of the LSU Coastal Sustainability Studio. With four massive hurricanes impacting our state between 2005 and 2008, the state has been forced to face with challenges of a changing landscape in urban and rural areas. Now, you mentioned the project in the 9th Ward. Where are some of the other ones?
Well, currently, over the last year, the CSS has teamed up with the Office of Community Development Disaster Recovery Unit for the state, that's OCDDRU, to run what's called the Louisiana Resiliency Assistance Program. That follows up on the OCDDRU's project called the Comprehensive Resilience Planning Program. And this was following Hurricane Gustav, about $9.5 million. It supported resilience planning work in communities, 30 communities across the state. And so our job in this partnership is to take all 30 of the planning projects and bring them together and sort of under one roof collate, collect, analyze, synthesize the data, and then to put it back out again in terms of education. We're running a website that we've recently completed. It's resiliency.lsu.edu, and we encourage everyone to go check it out. There's a wealth of information on resilience planning for our communities. And those plans are everything from land use plans to water management strategies to zoning ordinances. But the goal of the program was to, again, getting back to sort of the core values of the studio, is to bridge the gaps of what traditional land use planning might be when faced with an environment that is has a much greater amount of risk associated with it. So how do we deal with environmental problems through land use?
297-5633 for Jeff Carney of the LSU Coastal Sustainability Studio. Jeff is a graduate of Washington University in St. Louis and of the University of California at Berkeley. Where'd you grow up, Jeff?
I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware.
Wilmington, Delaware. Were you a Phillies fan?
I was a Phillies fan, yeah, yes,
that's
absolutely.
Good. That's good. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Good morning, Phil. You're on the air with Jeff.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning, Jim. Yes, sir. My question is this. I understand that in the study of hydrology or what or how water and river reacts, that this can, that what you find out or in your research at scale will translate into the real world. In other words, you can make a model of what a river will do in a lab and then use that information to predict what flooding will do later on. And I understand that the French government gave LSU that kind of model that is in one of the departments or in a lab at LSU right now to study just what happens with different models of control flooding.
If you're talking about a physical model, there is a physical model run by Dr. Clint Wilson, who's actually a executive board member for the Coastal Sustainability Studio, that is, quite large, maybe 100 feet square, that runs, actually pumps water through. It's a model of the lower river. That is a highly successful piece of work, and they're actually building a new one currently, which will be about four times the size, I believe. It's in the planning stages, but yeah, we actually have a history in Louisiana of large scale modeling, physical models of the sedimentation and the flooding potentials of the river. On the other hand, there's tremendous work being done at LSU looking at computational models of storm surge. Sediment flows, both from the Gulf in terms of storm surge and the Mississippi River in terms of moving sediment into the wetlands. Mm-hmm. One of the core, you know, values that the studio holds is how do we restore the Mississippi Delta Plain using the most powerful force that it actually has, which is the river. Historically, that's what built the Delta. And we've seen a tremendous decline in the Delta after the levees have been built over the last century.
Now, you have made great advances in the time that the Coastal Sustainability Studio has been up and going. And one of the areas where you are reaching out and getting involved with the public at large is through the web. How is that happening?
Well, we have our website, the website css.lsu.edu. I'd encourage you all to join there or go take a look. I would say, though, our most recent advance is the resiliency.lsu.edu website, and that we're actually running a series of webinars and workshops. The webinars are available to anyone who's interested, and these will be about resilience planning. This is part of the LRAP project, resilience planning in Louisiana. The next one, titled Retrofitting for Resiliency, will be on April 5th at 11:30 a.m. And I encourage everyone who was interested in listening in to actually email lrap@lsu.edu.
297-5633, still time to talk with Jeff Carney, director of the LSU Coastal Sustainability Studio. Stephen in Central Highlands. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air with Jeff.
Good morning, Jim. My question to the professor, the LSU professor, is, how can we trust anything coming out of LSU in regard to these types of issues after we saw what happened to Professor Van Herden? You know, can the Corps be criticized if that's where your studies lead you? Can the Department of Natural Resources be criticized if they fail to tell us about, for example, why a giant sinkhole has developed in our state and not tell us for over a year? And then if we look at the users of our drinking water aquifers by giant industrial, you know, corporations.
All right. What do you say about concealing information that might be detrimental to people who are in one way or the other associated with the university?
Well, that whole issue did precede me. I was not around when it happened, so I'm not completely knowledgeable to speak on it. However, we have found the university, in my experience through the CSS, been completely open to us speaking about the issues. One of the things that the CSS works hard to do is to bring people from different experiences, backgrounds, or frankly interest groups together around the table to actually talk about the things that we disagree about, whether it's industry, interests for restoration, community interests, history, people arguing for the history of communities. I mean, all of these interests have a very different way of seeing the problems. And so our goal really is to shed light on that.
297-5633. Lynn and Melrose, you're on WRKF with Jeff Carney. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning, Jim and Jeff. I have a million questions, which there isn't time for, but I'm curious how... Well, first of all, there's a workshop this Friday, this Thursday and Friday and Saturday, I believe, at the University of New Orleans. I'm supposed to participate in it on sustainable coasts. Elizabeth English is heading that effort. I wonder if you guys are involved. Number two, are you formally involved at all with the state through the Office of Coastal Protection and Restoration or with the Water Institute of the Gulf?
Yeah, the Building Resilience Workshop is a fantastic workshop. I've gone to it for the last few years. Unfortunately, I will be speaking about these issues in Nebraska on Friday afternoon, so I'll be out of town. Many of our staff from and other faculty members will be attending that workshop. In terms of our work with CPRA and the Water Institute of the Gulf, we've had a very close relationship with all of these organizations. There's a lot of people that we know and we communicate with. We haven't had a formal working relationship to date, always looking for opportunities to bring the ideas and working methods of the studio to bear on these groups. And I think that the work that has been done by the CPRA, the 2012 Master Plan, is truly an impressive document. We are 100% in support of it and very closely followed the progress and hope that our work can assist in the implementation of that plan.
How are the folks in Nebraska interested in what's going on with the Coastal Sustainability Studio?
That's a very good question. they actually are interested. Now, granted, they might not face sea level rise for quite some time, but they are extremely interested in the transdisciplinary research model that we've been developing. And so I'll be speaking to, we'll be speaking at the College of Design. However,
this is at the University of Nebraska?
Yeah, at Lincoln. Mm-hmm. So I'll be speaking to the College of Design. However, we will be a multidisciplinary group.
For those who'd like to look at a copy of the CSS annual report, is that online?
It actually is not right now, but it will be in the next few days.
And it's an extensive report about exactly the issues you're discussing.
Yeah, it breaks down our annual, the number of projects that we've done over the last year, the things that we're engaged in, and there's quite a few. It's quite a broad, broad research group.
Where do you go from here?
We are actually really interested in getting more engaged, and one of the core values to the studio, we have support from the university, we have support from industry through Chevron, we have support through the federal government through the LRAP program. So our support base comes from a lot of different things. One of the things I think we're really looking towards is building the workforce of tomorrow. All of these industries need to think outside of the box, past the disciplinary boundaries that they're used to, and realize that these problems aren't going away. I'd say that's a primary issue, and really to continue the program, the LRAP program, to building strong partnerships with our communities, and see the sort of breakdown of these disciplinary boundaries enable Louisiana to really think outside of the confines. There was the Louisiana Speaks project in 2007. If you look back towards the map that showed restoration projects, economic development projects, historic zones, transportation corridors, all of it on the same map. And that comprehensive thinking is really what the CSS is pushing for.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jeff Carney. Let's keep in touch. He is head of the LSU Coastal Sustainability Studio. Good to visit with you.
Thank you very much, Jim.
And tomorrow on this show, one of our guests, main guest, is slated to be Tim Barfield, the man who runs the Department of Revenue and Taxation in Louisiana. I think they now call themselves only the Department of Revenue. And, of course, Tim Barfield is weighing the proposal that Governor Jindal has floated with his involvement that would do away with the state income tax and increased state sales taxes, some say considerably, and on some items that have not been taxed before. So we will talk with Tim Barfield, if everything goes according to form, about this and much more, and we look forward to hearing from you tomorrow at this time. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, we thank you for listening today, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.